Great. Well, this is we're going to start early because we're full. Thanks for coming. Thanks especially to those of you in the front row. This is my first South by Southwest, but I understand that stage diving at the end of the speech is required, so thanks especially to you guys in the front row. Let me explain a little bit about how I got here and why I'm giving this talk. I'm a business school professor. I was at a school called IMD in Lausanne, Switzerland, and now I'm at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And I wanted to write a book. I was planning on writing a fairly boring book about innovation management. I believe that innovation is really important, and the way we're thinking about innovation is changing in some fairly important and dramatic ways, and so the way we manage innovation has to change. And so I was going to write a fairly typical business book where each chapter was a piece of the book and a piece of the framework and a case study from a company. And I did some case studies at Best Buy and McDonald's and CarMax and Mars and others. And then I went to Lego. And what I found at Lego was one of the most sophisticated systems for managing innovation that I'd seen anywhere in the world, plus this amazing kind of Greek tragedy of a company that was just a beloved company that almost put themselves out of business. In 2003, they were this close to bankruptcy because of some mistakes that I'll talk about. But as now, because of the way they manage innovation, one of the most profitable, fastest-growing, successful companies in the world. And so what I'm going to do is tell you this story. You know, it's kind of like I started out to write an academic business book, and I found a love story. So probably most of you know Lego, right? Most of you know the toys, the fire trucks and police stations and race cars. How many of you played with Bionicles as kids? Right? You wouldn't think that, you know, kids like action figures and kids like construction toys. Let's make a buildable action figure. You know, is that really kind of a blue ocean strategy? Is that some big innovation? They sold 190 million of those. That's greater than the population of the UK, Germany, and Italy combined. A billion-dollar product. Lego Star Wars, probably one of the great enduring business partnerships anywhere. Just renewed for another 10 years. A multi-billion-dollar product for both companies. And then Lego Duplo, kind of looking for blue ocean in the kids market, bigger bricks for smaller hands. So probably many of you are familiar with these products. You may not be familiar with some of their newer products, Lego Games. You know, everybody likes playing board games, but that process of, say, setting up Monopoly, where you have to sort out the properties and pass out the money and so forth, why not make the beginning of a game a Lego building experience? And why not make it so that you can actually take the faces off the die, put on different faces, and play the game differently each time, you know, in a very Lego way? And so the games come with instructions. Here's how we recommend you play it the first time, and then here's five other ways that you might play it by putting different faces on the dice and some different rules. Or maybe you're familiar with Lego Mindstorms, this fairly sophisticated robotics kit with an intelligent brick and sensors and motors. And this is an example of Lego Mindstorms that was built recently. And you can see down here, just barely, is the intelligent brick, and there's some sensors and motors. And the human record for solving a Rubik's Cube is 5.6 seconds. This one did it. It was enhanced with an Android phone in 5.3. Wow. All Lego toys. Or maybe you saw this. Lego just recently licensed what is sure to be a big property. It'll come out later this year, the Lego Lord of the Rings. So you're probably familiar with the toys, but what you may not be familiar with is the story. And you can kind of summarize it in one chart. This is Lego's sales since their founding in 1932. I've squashed the first 70 years, from 1932 to 93 is squashed. So these 70 years take about one-third, and then the last 17 take two-thirds. But you can see that Lego grew fairly slowly over the first part of its lifespan. And then when the grandson of the founder, a guy named Kjell Kirk, took over, it went through this spectacular growth period where it doubled in size every 5 years for 15 years, hit a dead spot, a stagnant spot for about 5 years, and then brought in an outsider who wanted to boost innovation. He was brought in to kind of restart that growth, to rekindle Lego's innovation, rekindled it in lots of different ways, and it all worked until it didn't. In 2003, they had a disastrous year. Sales flopped. 2004 was even worse. They were running out of cash. They had no committed lines of credit. They were this close to bankruptcy. I mean, this great company really was looking at liquidation. They were visiting Mattel to see if they could maybe sell themselves off. They almost went out of business. But what they did is they changed the management team. They changed the way they managed innovation. They put that in place over the next couple of years. And you can see there's kind of a slow growth period between 2003 and 2007. And then from 2007 to 2010, it really started to take effect. And they've been growing sales over that period at 25% per year and profits at 50% per year for those 3 years. Every year, 50% profit growth per year. One of the most successful companies in the world. And, you know, if I was to ask you before you came in this room to name a company in a viciously competitive global industry who's dominated that industry because of their ability to innovate that has to, you know, refresh their products every year or two, you'd probably have named Apple, right? And that's what everybody does. I mean, if you look at the lists of the world's most innovative companies, including, I got this at the airport on the way here, the latest issue of Fast Company lists the 50 most innovative companies. Apple's number one. Lego's not in the top 10. They're not in the top 20. They're not in the top 50 of this or any other list. I mean, it's this great untold story. And what I'm going to do is tell you the story. I'm going to focus mostly on this period between the late 90s and 2007 and just tell you through the story of some of their toys what it is they did to get innovation back on track and get their profits back on track. Now, this is a talk about innovation and management of innovation. And so I think before we go much further, we should probably agree on what we mean by innovation. So I'd ask you to think a little bit, what is your definition of innovation? How would you define an innovation? I'm not going to give you a quiz. I mean, that's kind of a natural tendency of mine as a professor. But I just want to show you some things and ask you, by your definition, is this an innovation? And I'm going to show you some things because I want you to think a bit about this. Because it matters in terms of where we go from here. And I'm going to start with a hard one. Is this an innovation? The iPod. Right? So not the first music player that didn't use a cassette or a disc or something, right? There's others. In fact, not even the first that had a hard disk in it. How many of you think that it was an innovation? All right, 61.3% of you, yeah? So. And the reason why is usually because, you know, it has a beautiful user interface. It changes the way people listen to music. On the other hand, some people think that it is somewhat incremental. It was an incremental improvement maybe over what was already there, but not enough to be considered an innovation. I wish that this was a smaller group we could talk about it. But how about iTunes? So iTunes comes out at the same time, basically. It has the 99 cent per song business model. It has the Fair Play copy protection system, which was the first one that was kind of struck the right balance, right? It made it fairly easy to buy and download a song, but fairly hard to send it to all your friends. And so it was good enough that almost all of the music companies, with the exception, of course, of Apple, right? Everybody but Apple Records put their music on iTunes. So how many say that that's an innovation? Oh, okay. Yeah, 72.3% of you. And so it did remarkably well. So a service, it sounds like, can be an innovation. It doesn't have to be a product. A service can be an innovation, by your definition. Excuse me, that was my lunch. Sorry. I feel better now. The Swiss Army knife. I don't know if you know why this was innovative. It was the first knife that had a spring mechanism that let you put devices on both sides of the knife. So it was very innovative for its time. My question is not, is this an innovation, but is this? 85 different tools, 28 screwdrivers, bicycle chain repair tool, pliers, fish scaler, laser pointer, compass. Innovation? Okay. Or take it a step further. Innovation? But it's creative, right? I mean, these are creative ideas, but are they innovative? Right, so what's the difference between creativity and innovation? It doesn't work, by the way, if you're kind of writing this down. What's the difference between creativity and innovation? You know, again, I wish we had time to talk about it because it's an interesting discussion, but, you know, creativity, you know, is coming up with good ideas. Innovation is about something practical or useful, you know, something that for some segment of the population delivers real value. And so while these may be creative ideas, maybe they're not innovations. Let me go to another one. Dell. Doesn't change anything about the PC, right? I mean, in terms of the product itself, but the way you configure, assemble, deliver was dramatically changed by Dell. Innovation? Yeah, okay. So a business process can be an innovation. ING Direct. Now, ING Direct comes out as a, what they want to be is your other bank. They start in Canada, then they go into Australia, they go into the US and France, Spain and Italy, and then Germany and the UK. What they go in with is a simple savings account, and then later simple loans. The idea being that you still pay your bills through your regular bank, but if you have, you know, $5,000, $10,000 that you need to keep in liquid for a rainy day, you put it in ING Direct. But if you call up ING Direct and you ask them a question, they'll answer the phone, right? If you keep calling, they'll put you at the back of the queue and make you wait longer. And if you keep calling, they'll fire you. They'll send you your money back. They're saying, we don't want a relationship with you. You know, we just want your money. Half of ING Direct's customers send the money and never call them back. You know, never contact them again. I mean, it's a wonderful business, right, if you can get it. So ING Direct is the fastest growing bank in history because they have no ATMs. They have no branches. They have very simple accounts, so there's very few transactions. They don't have to handle cash and a lot of paper. And so their cost structure is about 1/6 of a traditional bank, and they keep some of that and pass some of that along to their customers. Fastest growing bank in history. But less in terms of product, less in terms of service. Innovation? Okay, so a business model can be an innovation. And so there, I show you this categorization. There's a company called the Doblin Group that categorized innovations into 10 different categories. And there's lots of different ways of categorizing innovations. They say you can innovate in terms of your product. You can innovate in terms of a suite of products, a system of products. You know, Microsoft took Word and Excel and PowerPoint, three pretty mediocre products, and put it into Microsoft Office and boosted sales just by putting those together. You can innovate in terms of a service. You can innovate in terms of a channel to market, a different channel like Nike or the Apple Store. You can innovate in terms of your brand, in terms of your customer experience. Buying a Lexus is different than other cars. You can innovate in terms of your business process, your business model, the way you connect to other companies. There's, you know, there's lots of different frameworks like this. The reason I show this one is that they did the next step, and they went over a 10-year period and counted how many innovations were in each category. And what they found is that companies tend to innovate the way they're wired to innovate. You know, we set up processes, we set up structures, we hire people, and we set up reward systems to encourage the type of innovation that we've always done. But in terms of where value is delivered, where profits come from, it can be a very different picture. Right? It can come from, you know, where is Walmart? Where is ING Direct? Where is Dell? If you look at their primary innovations that really differentiated them, it's not in that center. And so I show you this because, going back to Apple, if you look at what the iPod was, if all they'd done is introduce that one device, would they be in such a dominant position today? No, of course not, right? It's because they were really doing all these different innovations. They worked with Toshiba to lock up the supply of the hard disk for 18 months. There's a 100-page catalog of complementary innovations, you know, docks and skins and chargers and things like that, that pay a fee to Apple. There's, of course, iTunes, which is a 99-cent per song business model, and the Fair Play copy protection system, the connection to all the different music companies that provides a very powerful service that supports the iPod. And then, of course, a compelling branding campaign, and then later the Apple Store, which was a new channel to market and a very compelling shopping experience. My favorite story about that being the Vanity Fair article, I don't know if you saw that, about the best place to meet men in New York City. It was the Apple Store, so compelling on many dimensions. And so this is one of the truths of innovation that we're seeing, that consultants and academics, and by the way, I spent 5 years at McKinsey and then did 6 years of startups back in the late 90s, and then I've been a business school professor for 10 years. So in terms of consultants and academics, when I give them a hard time, I'm kind of doubly guilty. And so what consultants and academics tell us about how to manage innovation is that we should explore this full spectrum of innovation. We should not just focus on products, but services, channels to market, business models, business processes, customer experiences. All those can be very powerful types of innovation. That's just one of the seven deadly truths of innovation. Some of the others: open up innovation, find blue ocean markets, practice disruptive innovation, hire diverse and creative people, walk in your customer's shoes, build an innovation culture. These are all things that academics and consultants have been saying to do for a while if we want to boost innovation in our companies, and are continuing to say today, and Lego did them all and almost went out of business. So let me talk just a little bit about what these are, just to make sure we're on the same page. Maybe some of you haven't heard about blue ocean or disruptive innovation. So just give me a few minutes and I'll go through the academic theory. Open innovation, the idea being that there's a lot more smart people outside your company than inside. Procter & Gamble wrote a wonderful article in the Harvard Business Review, and there's this book called Open Innovation by Henry Chesbrough. He's one of the guys that has done the most work on this. But Procter & Gamble said, you know, we've got 7,500 bright researchers inside the company. For every single one of those, we can identify and connect to 200 smart people outside. In other words, 1.5 million people. There's a lot more smart people outside the company than inside. And they actually set a target. They said, we have to set every product has to have some part from outside the company, some major technology or piece from outside the company. And if you don't get to half of the products having some major piece from outside the company, that's going to affect management bonuses. So they set a real target, and they did things like the potato chips, right? They found a small bakery in Italy that had already perfected a process for printing on cakes and cookies without changing the flavor. They licensed that process, and they were actually selling advertising impressions on their potato chips for a while, a lot faster to go outside and look for it than to do it, right? It changes the innovation process from problem solving to solution finding. The answer is already out there. It's just a matter of finding it rather than developing yourself, reinventing the wheel. Or as William Gibson, the science fiction writer, says, the future's already here. It's just unevenly distributed, right? And so you got to go out and find what the answer you're looking for. Disruptive innovation. This is Clayton Christensen, for those of you familiar with him at Harvard Business School. He argues that new technologies often disrupt, and the way they disrupt is they start out being much cheaper and much lower quality than the existing technology. And so for the steel business, there was blast furnaces were the dominant way of making steel. And the capability of the technology grew faster, that's the red line, than the demands of the market, which is the dotted line. And there's different levels of the market. Rebar is the lowest quality steel, and then bars and rods, structural steel, sheet steel, and then up to bearing quality steel. Well, when they first came out with electric arc furnaces, a different way of making steel, where you take three big electrodes and put it in a vat of scrap metal, it was pretty low quality and much lower cost. And so all they could really make by the time 1980 came around was rebar. And rebar is a small part of the market and a very unprofitable part of the market, so all the people in the integrated steel manufacturers let it go. But then the technology improved a lot more than the taste of the market. They took over bars and rods, structural, sheet, and now they're able to make bearing quality steel, and all the integrated manufacturers are out of business. The capability of the technology grew a lot faster than the needs of the market, and the disruptive technology drove out the dominant player in the market, the earlier generation of technology. And it's happened again and again. It's happened in disk drives. It happens in cameras. It may be happening in manufacturing right now. That's the MakerBot 3D printer, which you can, I've got one in my basement. I bought it for $750, and you can, you know, my kids, if they want toys, I just tell them to print it out, you know, make their own. Blue ocean markets. Blue ocean theory is this idea that if we can change a couple of dimensions and find an underserved portion of a market, we can go from red ocean, which is red because of the blood, because of the sharks and the battles, and you know, it's a bloody, difficult, competitive market, to a blue ocean where there's no competition. And so ING Direct is a good example of that. What they said is that there's some affluent savers that don't want a relationship with a bank. They just want some place where they could put $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 in case the furnace breaks or in case there's some emergency. And they don't want all the fine print complex rules. They don't need the ATMs on the corner. They've got their existing bank for that. And so by creating this other bank model, by creating this new bank, ING Direct, they were able to find a blue ocean and sail into that and do quite well. Similarly, Dell with PCs, Southwest Airlines in the airline business, Quicken with financial software all found blue ocean. So I'm not advocating these. I'm just saying these are very popular, and a lot of companies have spent a lot of money and hired a lot of consultants and hired a lot of professors to try and implement these. Other ones, hire diverse and creative people. That we can't hire people that look all the same. Otherwise, we're just going to get the same ideas. Walk in your customer's shoes. Really understand what your customer cares about. Build an innovation culture, one that values innovation and creativity. You know, Lego read this and really tried to implement all these things. They didn't hire necessarily consultants or read these books, but if you read these and you look at what Lego did, it lines up pretty well. They tried all of these things to boost innovation, and it almost put them out of business. So let me give you a little history and kind of tell you how that happened. And I'm going to start from the very beginning. Lego started in 1932, founded by Ole Kirk Christensen. His wife had just died, had four young boys, was having a hard time making ends meet as a carpenter, and so started making wooden toys. Then in 1947, he bought an injection molding machine over the objection of his sons, who thought that there was too big of a risk, started making plastic toys. The boys were playing in the wood shop one day, knocked over a stove, burned down the wood shop, so he went totally into plastic toys from there on. Patented the brick. His son, Godfred, took over and patented the brick, and they started making the Lego toys that we all know through the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, mostly just sets of everyday things, bricks to build houses and towns that you see, you know, that if you were a kid in those days. Did fine, you know, grew slowly, did fine, expanded out to Europe, a little bit into the U.S. But then in 1977, the grandson of the founder, Kjell Kirk Christensen, takes over and unleashes this burst of innovation that is incredible. Does a couple of really interesting things. First is Duplo, which had been kind of hanging around and had come out in different forms, but he really separated and branded it in 1977. Again, bigger bricks for smaller hands. Lego Technique. The idea being, whereas Duplo expanded into kind of blue ocean by going younger, Technique wanted to find blue ocean by going older. Kids leave Lego at age 11 or 12, and it's not cool anymore. So we thought, well, let's make something much more sophisticated with gears and beams and axles and motors and so forth, so we can do really sophisticated stuff, and we'll keep people playing with Lego for longer. It didn't really work for teenagers, but they did find this market of 25 to 55-year-old men that loved it, and so it did quite well. I used to make fun of those people until I became one. But I think the big innovation that Lego did, and I think it's really hard to overstate this, the impact of it, is the minifigure. This is the first minifigure. Came out in 1978, because I think those of you who are 45 and older had a very different play experience than those people that are 40 and younger. Because when the minifigure comes along, you can not only build that house, but you can kind of put yourself in the play experience. And maybe there's a couple different minifigures and you can play out little scenarios. And so it really changes the play experience in, I think, a pretty dramatic and powerful way. The other thing it does is that Kjell Kirk, again, the grandson of the founder, he changes the whole Lego system. You know, Lego is very much a system in play, is what they call it. And it's all scaled around the bricks so that they, you know, every piece fits with every other piece. Well, before 1977 and before the minifigure, there was actually a couple different scales. There was the town series, where you'd build a house that was four or five bricks tall. And then there was a train series that was five or six bricks tall. So the train cars would actually tower above a house. And then there was a family set, and grandma was eight bricks tall. So, you know, like some mutant from the 1950s would tower over the trains in the town. With the minifigure, everything started to be scaled to that same scale. And so it brought a discipline to the Lego system that really helped in my view. And then the last innovation that Kjell Kirk did, that happened under Kjell Kirk, more accurately, is these fantasy sets. So the castle set, the space sets. If you have these in your basement, they're worth thousands if they're in good condition. People loved these. It was the first time that it wasn't something that you would see every day, but really some different set. And there was also a little bit of drama involved in this. I mean, you can see on the box that there is the bad guys kind of marching on the castle defended by the good guys. Or here there's a red astronaut and a white astronaut. So there's some little bit of drama there, too. These sets were incredibly popular. And so for the next 15 years, LEGO continued to expand out into different types. They went to Wild West and underwater and pirates. They expanded geographically into Europe and the U.S., a little bit into Asia, and they just had this golden period where for 15 years, they doubled in size every 5 years, grew at 14% annual rate to double in size every 5 years for 15 years. Just a golden period. And then 1993 kind of stopped. You know, sales kind of plateaued. You know, there's a natural end to that growth. There's only so many shelves and so many toy stores around the world, and so the growth stopped. Also, Kel Kirk, the CEO, the grandson of the founder, got very sick, actually had a very serious disease and kind of backed away from the business, so the company was somewhat rudderless for a while. So sales stopped, and LEGO, to try and keep that growth going, actually tripled the number of new toys that it offered to the market. I'm changing the scales here, right? So this is sales. By the way, there's anywhere from 5 to 8 Danish kroner to the dollar if you want to convert back. And then this is the number of new toys. It goes from around 100 to about almost 350 over the course of these years. And so what do you think happens to costs? Right, to go up? What happens to profits? They tank. LEGO has its first loss in company history in 1998. Kjell Kirk Christensen, the grandson of the founder, he says, I've been in charge of this company for 20 years. Maybe it's time for me to step aside. Brings in an outside turnaround expert, a guy named Paul Plowman, who had turned around Bang & Olufsen, the Danish consumer electronics company, quite successfully, and brings him in to turn around LEGO. He goes out and he starts looking at the market and realizes that some things have changed. For one, kids are getting older, younger. They're going into video games. They're leaving LEGO sooner. And it's happening not just for LEGO, but for Barbie, for Hot Wheels, for other toys. The channel has changed. The companies that sell LEGO, like Toys R Us, Metro, Carrefour, Target, are becoming much more sophisticated. It's not the mom-and-pop toy shop anymore. Meanwhile, other toys that you could buy instead of LEGO have moved their production from the U.S. to China, and so gotten much cheaper. The Danish kroner has actually gotten stronger, and so there's a double effect, and you know, LEGO is becoming much more expensive than the alternative toys that you might buy for your kids. And lastly, all the patents have expired, and so anybody can make a LEGO brick, and many do. In fact, there's 5 or 6 companies still making LEGO-compatible bricks that snap together with LEGO. And so they realize they need to do something big. You know, they need to do something. You know, they're really concerned. This is the late 90s, right? They're concerned that the brick is passé, that they need to get, you know, kind of move with the wired world and think about, you know, how they might really innovate. Because while they're missing all these things, they do still have a strong brand, a good bank account, loyal customers, a great distribution network, smart employees, you know, talented people, and a solid bank account. They've got all this going for them. And so they create what consultants use as a case study of what you should do, which is this vision statement. We want the LEGO brand to become the world's strongest brand among families with children by 2005. This comes out in February 2000. Internally, the CEO, this Paul Plowman, is given a bonus, a big, huge bonus, if he's able to get the revenue, a growth rate, back to what it was in the 80s. Right? If he can double the size of LEGO between 2000 and 2005, he'll get a big bonus. So there's a growth target as well as an innovation target. And so they go out and they start doing all these things. Again, you know, they didn't necessarily hire consultants, but if you look at what these gurus and consultants are recommending and look at what LEGO did, it lines up pretty well. For example, they acquired an intelligent toy company in California. They opened up an internet business in New York. They opened up a new media group in the UK. they opened up a kind of Lego Alessi design studio down in Milan, Italy. You know, they realized that you can't make toys for the world's kids in the middle of nowhere Denmark. I mean, Billund, Denmark is 2 hours from everything. There's 2 hours of nothing in every direction. This, the people here from Lego, you know, they come here, they think this is great spring weather. There's a Legoland amusement park, but to try and get blue ocean, you know, the most amusement parks are targeted toward teenagers. Legolands are targeted toward a younger age, and so there really is some opportunity there. So they start opening up some more amusement parks in Munich, in the UK, in California. They partner, you know, to open up innovation, and again, looking for new opportunities, they come up with after-school education programs. These are quite popular, especially in Asia. Korea, Japan, you know, kids have anywhere from 10 to 14 different after-school activities every week. And so they say we can use Lego to teach science, technology, engineering, and math, create a whole curriculum, find some centers, partner with somebody to implement it, and start expanding that. They partner with Steven Spielberg and do a movie studio where you can do stop-motion animation and other types of movies. They really try and understand their market, not just the kids that build with Lego, but the kids that don't. And they find that 3/4 of kids actually don't like building toys. And so they create this whole line of toys called Jack Stone that snap together in 5 to 10 minutes and you can start playing with it. They create a toy called Galador. Galador is, again, an attempt to kind of expand the full spectrum. It's not just a toy where you can snap off arms, legs, heads, but also it has electronics in it, so you can play little games on the toy. They commission a TV show. If you watch the TV show with your toy, it'll talk back to the TV show. They commission a game, a video game from Electronic Arts. If you play the video game with your toy, it'll talk back to that. They have a whole rich story around it, you know, trying to do the full spectrum of innovation. To find blue ocean in the toddler market, this Lego Alessi design studio, you know, Alessi is just kind of a term. It's a design studio in Milan. They create a set of intelligent toys. So this one, if a toddler drags it behind, it'll play music, and if you plug in a different mushroom-shaped module in it, it'll play a different song. To disrupt, you know, they think, well, how could we do Lego without Lego, you know, without plastic? So they create something called Lego Factory with a 3D CAD system called Lego Digital Designer, where you can actually build Lego without any plastic bricks. You can build it virtually in 3D. You can still get this at Lego Digital Designer. Just Google that, and you can download it and use it. So you can build Lego without Lego. They're trying to disrupt themselves, which is what the theory says they should do. And overall, you know, they're just spinning off one innovation after another. There's lots more that are out there. But they created a culture that really valued innovation, that really valued kind of putting out new big things. And like I said, it all worked until it didn't. They hired a young consultant named Jørgen V. Knudstorp, and he did a couple of projects, was running business development. They started hearing noises from the market in 2002 that 2003 might not be a good year. 2002 had been pretty good, almost record-setting. But 2003, they're hearing things. And they said, why don't you go look into it? He comes back, presents to the board of directors. You know, sitting there is the grandson of the founder, Kjell Kirk. And he says, we are in trouble. 2003 is going to be a terrible year. 2004 is going to be worse. We have no cash. We have no committed lines of credit. We may not make it. We are on a burning platform. And furthermore, we have destroyed $1.6 billion in economic value over the past 10 years. In other words, if you as the founding family, the ownership family of Lego, it's still a privately held company, if you had taken your money 10 years ago, put them in risk-free government, Danish government bonds, you would be $1.6 billion richer today than you are because you put that money in Lego. You've been destroying, this company has been destroying value at the rate of $500,000 every day for 10 years. What had happened is that innovation had succeeded. They got lots of innovation. What they didn't get was a lot of profitable innovation. They really only had 3 profitable toys: Lego Star Wars, Lego Harry Potter, and Bionicles. And Lego Star Wars and Harry Potter were only profitable in years where there was a movie. If you remember, Star Wars had a movie in 1999 and 2002. Harry Potter had a movie in 2001 and 2002. There was no Harry Potter or Star Wars movie in 2003 or the first half of 2004. Sales of those toys went right through the floor. all they had was Bionicle. Thankfully they did, or they would definitely be out of business. And so they almost went out of business. The board didn't believe it. I mean, they were shocked by this report. But they did their homework. They found out that this young guy, Jordan B. Nootstorp, was right. They fired the president, Paul Plowman. They asked Jordan B. to run the company. He was 34 years old at the time. He took over the company. What happened over the next couple years was he started changing the way they managed innovation. So I'll talk to you about that. And, you know, I'll come back to this. Is there something wrong with this list? Are we as consultants and academics telling companies something that they shouldn't do? And so what I'll do is I'll kind of tell you the turnaround just quickly. I have a hard time, by the way, talking about Lego in less than 6 hours. So I hope you're... I hope you're comfortable. I may not know when to stop. What I want to do is tell you, kind of sketch out the recovery in six toys. There's a lot more to it, but I think it'll give you a feel for what kinds of things they did. The first toy is the fire truck. This was the fire truck that Lego brought out in 1997. It wasn't a great fire truck, wasn't bad. This was the Jack Stone fire truck that I talked a little bit about in 2001 that snapped together very quickly. Mads Nipper, he's the head of all, right now, of all of product development and marketing for the company. He pulls everybody together who's involved in developing new products, and he holds up that one in the upper left. And he says, you know, this wasn't a great fire truck. It was okay. It wasn't great. But this is not a fire truck. This is a spaceship. You know, we will never build something like this again. And then he holds up this. This is a fire truck. This is the kind of toy that made Lego great. It looks like Lego. You can see the studs on the top. It's built from what they call universal pieces. And let me talk a little bit about that. That these pieces here can only really fit together in one way. They're not that Lego-y. Whereas the pieces on the fire truck, you can take them apart and put them together in lots of different ways. You can build lots of different fire trucks or a spaceship or an airplane or whatever because they're very flexible and universal. And C said, this is Lego. We will never build something like this again. And I would argue that the fire truck may be the most important toy in Lego's history because it became kind of a symbol for what Lego could and should become again. Right? Other groups have told me that they actually would talk about what is our fire truck? You know, what is our return to the core of that core Lego experience using those more flexible pieces and making it more like Lego used to be when we were kids. The other thing that happened with innovation is that the number of different pieces in the inventory exploded. This is the actual numbers. This is the number of elements. And an element is a combination of a shape and a color. And it just exploded. You can see, especially at that 1993, where the sales started to tail off and they tripled the number of products, you can see it climbing fairly dramatically. There was a huge debate within Lego about should they cut the number of elements in half or not. The designers were saying, we really need, you know, the lots of different shapes so we can build lots of different toys. The manufacturing supply chain people, as you can imagine, were saying, you're killing us. You know, it's so complex, it's so costly, we're never going to make money with all these different pieces. But one guy, a guy named Henrik Weiss-Albeck, he pulls together these three things and takes them to a management meeting and says, here are our 8 policemen. Here's 3 bad guys. Here's 3 of our 6 chefs. We've got a lot of variety that has no real value. Right? I mean, this chef is actually slightly different than this one. Some of the designers were actually designing their own faces. Right? They were immortalizing themselves in Lego. Said, so we can cut this. And so they did. They cut out the number of, you know, policemen and bad guys and chefs and cut the number of pieces in half. And they said, you know, what happened is the designers rediscovered what Lego was all about. How, you know, you can't just ask somebody to make up a new mold for some car fender. You have to figure out how to do it out of the flexible pieces that can be recombined in lots of different ways. They rediscovered what Lego was all about. And by reducing the number of pieces, the volume for each piece increases dramatically, and Lego is really a fixed-cost business, so the profits go up pretty dramatically. What they didn't expect was that the fan community reacted. when they cut out 5 of the 6 chefs, some of the fans responded saying, "You killed my chef. I loved that guy." And so they had a memorial service for the dead chefs. You know, he's no longer with us. We loved him too. Bionicles is was the toy that saved Lego, basically. I mean, if it hadn't been for Bionicles and the profits in 2003, the company would not have survived. So Bionicles is anchored by this very rich story, which changes each year. Right? There's a whole different story with different characters. The first year, the Toa Mata arrive in Mata Nui and are attacked by the infected Rahi, which are the spawn of the evil Makuta force. Some of you know this, right? And then they go in the second year, and the Toa face the Borak, and they get infected by the energized Protodermis and become the Toa Nuva, who are attacked later by the Paraka when they go to the Isle of Voia Nui, right? After they go from Mata Nui to Metru Nui to Voia Nui. And so every year there's different characters, different bad guys. They're all spawned by the evil Makuta force. But if you read the books, or if you watch some of the web cartoons, you realize that you need all 4 of the Toa if you're going to do battle with all 4 of the Rahi. I mean, take it from somebody who is the father of a 7-year-old son, and you demand incessantly that you get all 4 of those Toa so they can battle all 4 of the Rahi. And so it became a very successful toy. And kids who love Bionicles, the Bionicle boy, just wanted to wear Bionicle clothing, wanted to sleep in Bionicle sheets and pajamas, wanted to wear a Bionicle backpack, read the Bionicle books, was a walking advertisement for Bionicles, which is why they went so viral. And Lego got some revenues, some licensing revenues from each of these different products. And by the way, the story of Bionicles is a fascinating one just looking at it from an open innovation perspective. Because the way this rich 9-year story happened was that Lego sent a Bionicle to its advertising agency, Advance, in Copenhagen. And there was a guy there named Christian Faber, and they said, "Draw the worlds that this creature lives in." Now, Christian had just been diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor, and he didn't know how long he was going to live. He had to take medicine to keep it under control, which thankfully he's still around. He was able to do. But he started thinking, what if these weren't life-size people? What if instead this was some kind of nanotechnology medicine? And what if instead of Mata Nui as an island in the ocean, it's actually the crusted over face of a giant robot? And as we go from Mata Nui to Metru Nui to Voia Nui, we're actually traveling around inside the robot, and the Makuta force is like the cancer, and it's spawning different types of antibodies to try and reject the Bionicle medicine. And finally, at the end of the 9 year, only 3 people know about this kind of red thread connecting the different stories. And at the end of the 9 year thing, they defeat the Makuta force, the robot gets up out, and then blasts off into space. Well, that whole story actually comes from outside Lego. But that rich story with all the different characters that change year to year as they go around the different parts of the robot spawned huge amounts of sales, and it became a blockbuster toy. The problem was that it only lasted a year. These were meant to be collectibles. And so what would happen is that they develop the toy for a year, they put it into production, they're making the molds and the boxes and everything, they put the toys in the market for a year, and then they leave the market. Well, now think about it. If you're making pajamas, T-shirts, books, things like that, and you're trying to get from Lego, you know, tell me, you know, what are the characters, what's the story, what kind of things can I make, what are the pictures, what are the fonts, what can I do? And Lego isn't telling. What was happening was Lego was finishing up the development, communicating out to the outside partners. They were going back and forth, and you know, by the time they got the products out in the market, they were almost obsolete. You know, you ended up with 50,000 pairs of pajamas that were last year's toys on them, and so it became a problem. And Lego realized that it actually had to change the way they developed toys, not for their own purposes, but for their partners' purposes. And so they put in some gates in the development process, some review points in the development process, and said, we will have our materials ready for the partners at this. And that almost worked, but what they found was that they needed a licensing group, a group of people whose job it was, whose bonus depended on getting outside revenues from these companies that made the T-shirts and the books and so forth. And those people would knock on the door of the development team and say, you know, tell us the story, tell us the information, and they would put together a style guide that had lots of information about, you know, who is the Bionicle Boy, who are the characters, what's the story, fonts and screenshots and ideas for products. And then the whole thing started to work. You know, they had this licensing group. They had a new step in the process. They redesigned the process, not for themselves, but for the broader ecosystem of partners that were together producing revenues for the Bionicles. Mindstorms. Mindstorms was this computer product, this robotic system that I showed you at the beginning of the talk. So Mindstorms was first introduced in 1998. This is actually the second generation, not the first generation. The first generation introduced in 1998. It was the highest selling box, you know, of a single SKU, for those of you familiar with the terminology, of any toy in LEGO history. It does very well. It comes around to 2004. They're looking for revenues. They're trying to recover. They realize that there's a lot of potential here. They haven't done much with it. It's almost like they're deliberately trying to kill it. The problem is that they fired everybody who knew anything about the product. There's like one guy left. In the layoffs of 1998 and 2003, a lot of the experts in Mindstorms have left. But there's this incredible network of adult fans who love Mindstorms, who get together and talk about it, who have, you know, through the internet, you know, maybe they wouldn't reveal their love for Lego in a neighborhood barbecue, but the internet has let them kind of come out of the closet and reveal their love for Lego to each other, and they connect up and they start creating clubs and meetups and conferences where they show off their creations with Mindstorms. And so the team, kind of out of desperation, says we need to work with these outside partners, these adult fans of Mindstorms, and bring them into our process and get their help in developing the next generation of the toy. And so they do. They send an email. They find four people. They say, would you like to be part? You know, if you do, sign this uber top secret agreement. That was the actual wording. The people write back within minutes, yes, we'd love to. And then they say, like Steve Hasenplug says, I've got my friend Dave. Bruce, you know, can he join too? And so they expand it to 11. They keep working and helping LEGO develop the toy. January 2006, they take this this robot, you know, one of the things that you can build with the kit, to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. And they say, we want 100 people that will help us develop the toy, you know, write up magazine articles, develop an educational curriculum, create models, test the toy, you know, all the kinds of things that they need to do. And they think maybe we'll get 1,000 applications for people who will pay, you know, full retail price for the kit. So, you know, for the privilege of getting it 8 months early, they think maybe we'll get 1,000 applications. They get almost 10,000 applications. And they choose the best 100 to join this development team, this secret development team. And then they start working, and what happens is these guys just flood the LEGO team with ideas. We should do this. We should do this. What about this? We can add some pieces here and make this, and this model would be so cool, and why don't we add that, and why don't we change that? And the LEGO team, you know, a small group within LEGO, you know, they're just overwhelmed. They're trying to get the product out to market. They're not responding. And this guy, Steve Hasenplug, he calls up Soren Lund, the team lead in within LEGO, and says, you know, you're either going to have 100 happy people or 100 unhappy people at launch in August. And right now, you're heading the wrong direction. You know, you got to do something about it. And so what they do is they hire somebody was actually laid off, as their community organizer, if you will. You know, somebody to kind of organize the community and help them in a productive way to influence the development of the Mindstorms. Because there's a real difference between managing people who are helping you because they want to versus managing employees who are doing what they have to, right? If I come to you, if you're my boss and I come to you and I say, we should do this, and you say, well, you know, we got to make this, you know, $250 US, so no, we can't do that. And I come back maybe a second time, and you say, no, I probably don't come back a third time. These guys, they come back 100 times. They never stop. And Soren Lund has this phrase, said, if you don't hire them, you can't fire them. Right? They're very powerful, very smart, very enthusiastic, but it's a different management skill. And so they realize that if they're going to do crowdsourcing, they need to do some crowd control. And where they end up with is they really organize them into a hierarchy where they have at the top the LEGO team, and they put a LEGO team member in contact with somebody who's in charge of hardware, like the sensors and motors, with somebody who's in charge of software, the programming language, and somebody who's in charge of construction, what you would build with the toys, the kinds of models you could build. And then there's a team underneath that team leader, and then there's the larger community, and it's this kind of hierarchical structure, which, for those of you who are familiar with Linux, is the way Linux works, right? They have a 6 layers of hierarchy, whereas, you know, this, there's somewhat less. But this was actually the idea of the community. The community suggested this, because what happens now is that most of the questions and ideas get filtered out within the community, but the best stuff goes up. Lego listens to that, it responds to that, it brings it back into the community and asks questions, and the whole thing is working better. Right? By putting hierarchy in there, everybody's happier. Lego is gets most of the questions answered and filtered out, but still gets amazing feedback and help in terms of what the design is. And they're giving more and more control and authority over to the user community, because they are so valuable to them and so sophisticated. And so it really is a different way of developing, and it's taken Lego a while to understand how to manage that. And it is a different set of management skills. And when it was launched, actually, in 2006, it was a tremendous success. And what Lego did largely was turn over the interviews, the press interviews, to the users, who were actually much more believable, much more enthusiastic, and in some cases more knowledgeable than the Lego people were, you know, especially some PR person, about what the toy could do. So a lot of the marketing was actually done by these 100 users who actually paid for the privilege of helping Lego. But, you know, another thing that Lego did is they started putting some discipline around this whole idea of developing the full spectrum of innovation. They created what they call their innovation matrix. And so they have the different types of innovation that they care about. I wrote a piece about this with Per Euler from Lego in Harvard Business Review, if you want it. And also, they have, on the vertical dimension, everything from very incremental at the bottom to very revolutionary types of innovation at the top. And what they started doing was asking their teams to think about not just what the product would be, but also what complementary products, like the iPod with iTunes and the store and everything else, what complementary products would really help make sure that that product is a success. And so now, like for Mindstorms, as an example to illustrate this, you know, they have the sensors in the programming language. They make it in the same way. They sell it in the same way. But they're also going to have an educational program to use this to teach robotics in middle schools, high schools, and universities. But the really innovative part and the real challenge and the real risk, innovation risk, was actually opening up innovation and involving the users. And so they started asking their teams to think about what is the different types of innovation that would make your product much more successful. Not just asking for it, but demanding that the teams think about the full spectrum of innovation. Because when you really think about this, when you map it, it changes the way you staff your team. It changes the way you fund your team. It changes who reviews that team. It changes how you reward them. It changes the results you get. Most companies I know, very few, actually do this. Most companies just develop the products, right? Lego is now not just asking, but demanding they develop the full spectrum of innovation. And they even restructured the company around it. So they took this innovation matrix, and this is again in the Harvard Business Review article, they actually can map who's responsible for each type of innovation according to what quadrant of the matrix, what portion of the matrix it is. They took user involvement a step further. There was a business development guy named Pal Smith-Meyer who found an architect in Chicago who was building 9-foot-tall versions of the Sears Tower and the Empire State Building, and they thought, well, that's cool. You know, maybe we can make a kit. They created this architecture series kit, which is actually a pretty innovative business model. Lego is now publishing other people's Lego models. I mean, think about that. That's very different than designing it yourself and making it yourself. Now they have this Adam Reed Tucker, whose signature is on every one of these boxes. This outside person is designing a series of Lego toys that are doing quite well. And it's also an innovation in terms of how it's sold through Barnes & Noble, through museum shops, and, you know, channels that Lego hadn't used before. So they're even going a step further and actually turning over control of the development of an entire line of toys to somebody outside the company. And they went a step further recently. I don't know if you saw Kyuso. Kyuso is Japanese for wish, although one of my students told me the way I say it, it's Japanese for shit. But any of you who have a great model and you wish LEGO would make it, you can post it on QSO. And if 10,000 people wish that LEGO would make that, then they will. And so the first one, actually, this started in Japan. This is the Shinkai 6500 submersible vehicle. It's the submarine that goes, the manned submarine that goes deepest underwater, designed by Japanese scientists. But the most recent one, for those of you interested in Minecraft, there was it's a natural kind of partnership, right? So they create a Minecraft LEGO toy, and it does tremendously well, and LEGO just announced that they're going to come out with LEGO Minecraft toys. And coincidentally, Minecraft, I don't know if you saw that there's a texture pack now that makes Minecraft blocks look like LEGO blocks. And so there's this wonderful partnership between two very similar companies. So if any of you have a toy that you want LEGO to make, you can go up on QSO, and there's this big tournament that's ongoing where LEGO will turn your toy into a kit, and you'll actually get royalties from the sales of that kit. So they're turning it over in an even more extreme way to the community. And so, you know, this, again, there's lots more that we could say, but LEGO has done a lot of things to turn what was a disastrous situation into a much more successful situation. And I'll come back to this question I asked you earlier, which is there something wrong with this picture? Is there something wrong with these seven truths? Because academics consultants are still saying, you know, we should be managing innovation this way. And the best analogy I can think of to explain, and I talked about this with Yiren V, the CEO, I said, the best analogy is actually the Darwin Award winner from 1995. Now, the Darwin Awards, you're probably familiar, right? It's the award given to people who die in such spectacularly stupid ways that they enrich the human gene pool by removing themselves from it. The Darwin Award is, Darwin, it was about, you know, survival of the fittest. Darwin Awards are about extinction of the stupidest. 1995 Darwin Award winner, thankfully apocryphal, was a guy who strapped a jet engine to the back of a Chevy Impala, went out to the Arizona desert, took off down the road, lit off the jet engine, the car takes off down the road. About a mile further down, there's skid marks where the tires melted, and, you know, he's tried to put on the brakes, but the tires melted. The car gets airborne. A little bit further down the road, the road turns, and there's a sheer cliff face. 125 feet up the cliff face, there's an impact crater 3 feet deep, and just small pieces of car and jet engine scattered around. And so I said to my friends at LEGO, I said, that was you. You know, the problem is not that those seven truths didn't work. The problem is that they did, right? They accelerated innovation beyond what you could control, that you strapped on these engines of innovation, blue ocean, disruptive, whatever, and your company took off. And, you know, whereas, you know, a steering wheel and brakes and a shifter are fine when you're just driving down the road, they're not that much help when you're flying through the air like an unguided missile. And so to kind of take the analogy further, you know, what you do when you fly an airplane is you've got a very different guidance system, control system, right? You don't have a steering wheel, brakes, and shifter. You have strats and flaps and rudders and then you have all the knobs and gears and dials and switches to control them. And so, you know, a guidance system, you know, LEGO basically strapped on wings and learned how to fly, just barely missing the cliff, barely missing bankruptcy, and now they're like a jet, you know, flying at 30,000 feet, doing quite well. But a guidance system for an airplane has three parts. You know, where do we want to go? What's our direction? Where are we now? What's our position? You know, both a car and an airplane have a GPS, but of course the airplane's is much more sophisticated. It has, you know, it can tell you not just where you are on longitude and latitude, but also elevation, speed, where the other airplanes are. And then finally, controls are much more sophisticated in an airplane. Well, you know, there's such a thing as an innovation guidance system. And if you're going to boost innovation like LEGO did, you much need a much more sophisticated way of controlling that. And in a way, that's, you know, that's what LEGO did. You know, what I showed you with some of these toys is all the different ways that LEGO is kind of channeling innovation in the company. You know, the way it's giving people not just the space to create, but the direction to deliver, you know, so that they know what kind of toys they want and they're not going off in all different directions and they're delivering profitable innovations. That, in fact, you know, when we go through there, we saw some examples here. In terms of direction, they're much more tied into their customers. They're working with them not just to understand what toys are going to succeed and not, but even taking it the next step and getting ideas for new toys from their customers. In terms of positioning, there's lots of processes. We talked about how Bionicles changed the process to incorporate the needs of their outside partners. We talked about for cutting the number of elements, there's now something called the Design Lab, where there's three crusty guys with 90 years of Lego experience between them who keep the number of elements in check so that the production process doesn't go out of control. And there's lots of tools like the Innovation Matrix, the Style Guide. There's roles that help control things. So the business development manager who found that architect, the community organizer who helped with the Mindstorms community, the licensing group that worked with the Bionicles partners. There's all these people who are out there whose job it is not to create, but to provide direction and funnel that innovation effort so that it is delivering profits for Lego. And in fact, it has. Again, you know, you look at what has been a down market in the toy industry since 2008, it has not been a down market for Lego. In spite of some very tough market conditions, Lego's been growing sales at 25% per year and profits at 50% per year. I haven't incorporated the results that just came out a few days ago because I'm not sure I understand them yet, but doing tremendously well in a tough market. And so kind of just to sum it all up, and then I'll take some time for questions, you know, yes, they're customer-driven, but they're going way beyond that and engaging with their customers, working with their customers to really understand how to drive new development. Yes, they hire diverse and creative people, but they're also hiring a lot of people to funnel the effort, to direct the effort of those diverse and creative people. They're thinking outside the box, but they, by thinking outside the box, they almost forgot what was in the box, which is insanely profitable plastic bricks. And so now they're separating organizationally those people who are thinking outside the box from the people that are thinking inside the box. And if your job is to develop the new police station or fire truck, that is your job, and you're given very clear directions to do that. And actually, some people are actually happier to have that structure on it. Because whereas before, you know, one or two out of 10 toys would get to market, if you're working on that fire truck, there's an 80% chance that that toy is going to be out in the market. And it's a different kind of satisfaction from your job, but a very important kind of satisfaction. Look for blue ocean, yeah, but if you're a shark, you love red ocean. And Lego's the shark in construction toys. Develop a full spectrum of innovation, but using that matrix, they're demanding that they be coordinated so those different types of innovation complement and support each other. Open up innovation, yes, but you got to learn new skills. Crowdsourcing requires some crowd control. And lastly, there's still an innovation culture. I would argue that now they really have an innovation culture, not just focused on creativity, but creativity and profitability. And so, you know, they almost crashed, barely survived, and now they're a plane flying at 30,000 feet. So with that, turn it over to you. Thank you. So we have some time for questions. There is a microphone up here, so if you have a question, please come up. There are some people from Lego here, so I'm a little bit scared that somebody's going to come up and say, that's not it at all. If there are any errors, it's purely mine.
Hi. I actually know a lot of that Bionicle story, by the way. So a question I have is in following the story arc as a consumer and as a parent, I love the fact that it really appeals to that, you know, that boy builder and that kind of nerd culture, which I celebrate and live in, and that it, you know, jumps the shark over the teen years and keeps us all happy through our middle age. What I don't understand in the context of this, which is fascinating, is where the Friends line fits in, because I've seen multiple iterations of the pink Lego, and it's really off-putting when you walk into a Lego store and see that whole pink display for the new girl-oriented Friends line. And I'm just curious, within the context of the business model and the culture of innovation, how that fits into the overall framework and the demographics of the business.
Oh, boy. Yeah, do you guys have another hour? Because I think it's a really important question. And so for those of you not familiar with the Friends controversy, there was a viral video that came out right around Christmas time by a little four-year-old named Riley, where she's walking through the toy aisle, and she starts saying, why are all the girls toys pink. Now, I don't like pink. You know, why do the boys' stuff have to be lots of colors and the girls' stuff have to be pink? And it went viral, got 16 million views last I checked. At the same time, Lego comes out with its new Lego Friends line, which is a pretty interesting line. You know, it's a line that has more girly themes to it. So there's a beauty shop, and there's a cafe. There's an inventor's workshop. There's some other thing. There's a veterinarian, and there's a protest. So there's something on change.org where people start up a petition saying, you know, this toy actually has is reinforcing the wrong stereotypes among girls. And, you know, I've got an 11-year-old daughter, so I'm concerned about this stuff myself. And so I bought some of the toys for her and watched her play with them. And, you know, it was just interesting to see what she was doing and what she wasn't doing. And, you know, she loved the toys. One of the first things I noticed, by the way, is that I went to Target, and all of the Friends toys were gone except the inventor, kind of the least girly one. That was still on the shelves. But all the other ones, the shelves were completely empty in Target, which is, Target's pretty good about restocking things. And then I watched her play, and what she did was she did two out of the three types of Lego play. She did the build to the instructions, and then she did the role play once it's built, but she didn't do the creative reconstruction part. But, you know, she actually, I thought about it, and the other thing, she doesn't do much of that either. There was a guy named Mark Stafford, and give me just a second, because he did a very interesting response to it, where he created something with the Lego toys. I should have put this in here. Should have known I got the... And by the way, you know, my daughter, you're talking about Bionicles. My daughter and my son were playing in the next room, and I was listening to them play, and my son, this was when he was about 8, and she was 6. And so she was still following him and doing whatever he wanted her to do, you know, kind of looking up to her big brother. And so he said, okay, now I'm going to take these two Bionicles, and you're going to take these two Bionicles, so we're going to have a big fight. And we'll fight, and we'll fight over the castle, and then whoever wins, and you know, we'll be the champion. And she said, yes, and then after that, we'll sing, and we'll dance, and we'll get married, and we'll live happily. So she loves Bionicles, but the play experience is somewhat different for the two. Well, I'm sorry, I won't take your time looking for it. But what this designer within Lego named Mark Stafford did is he took the pieces from the Lego Friends set, and he actually rebuilt them into a kind of fierce robot warrior, piloted inside by one of the Lego Friends girls. And it's got a big gun in one hand made out of pink bricks, and out of the other hand, it's got a big claw, and the teeth of the claw are actually the lipsticks from the beauty parlor. And so I think in a very kind of fun, natural way, he showed that that Lego creative experience is just as possible with the Lego Friends sets as it is with any other type of set. And, you know, my view is, you know, and this is just my personal view, and I don't know anything about, you know, children and roles and the effect of society. I mean, I watch it with my daughter. But there is something about Lego that the kind of 3D building experience, the fine motor control, the spatial reasoning and understanding that Lego really helps. And if, you know, the Friends set or any other set kind of gets girls and boys, you know, playing with that, I think that's a really valuable type of creative play. Lego also decided to meet with the people that started the petition. They did a big response. You can see it on the website. They talked about how, you know, this is one type of Lego play. There's lots of other types that are available to girls and boys. And then one of the fans actually started a petition against the petition. So, you know, the community rose up and responded, because I think Lego is very good at working with their community. And when they had this type of negative viral response, Lego was very good at kind of respecting the responses of the community, talking about it, and the whole thing pretty much has gone away. Other questions? Okay. Well, thanks for coming. Enjoy the rest of South by Southwest. And ready?